Okay, thank you.
Please proceed, Mr. Hillis.
May it please the court. For a perjury or obstruction enhancement to apply, the government must prove the elements and the district court must make the necessary findings of those elements. Neither thing happened here, and so the enhancement is improper. A defendant commits perjury by giving false testimony, doing so willfully, that is to say with specific intent, and makes the testimony on a material issue. For that matter, obstruction requires proof and a finding that a defendant willfully tried to improperly influence a witness. In this case, the only evidence the district court relied on to impose an enhancement under 3C1.1 was the PSR, and that is demonstrated through appendix page 11. There's nothing where the district court
relied on. Mr. Hillis, why was there a need for anything more? It is established doctrine that if the defendant says he accepts the findings of the pre-sentence report, that all the judge needs to do is say, okay, I endorse them. And that's exactly what happened here. Mr. Burgess said, I have no objection to anything in the pre-sentence report.
Your Honor, that would be aggressive reading of waiver. And so under Johnson versus Zerps, waiver is supposed to be construed liberally in favor of a defendant.
Yes, Mr. Hillis, we know your view on waiver. You don't think it exists, but we do, right? It's a fairly simple doctrine that if the defendant accepts the pre-sentence report, the judge can do so too, right? Or to put it otherwise, judges exist to resolve controversies among the litigants. There was no controversy among the litigants about these issues. Why should the judge have to do anything?
Judges must follow procedure and must make necessary findings under Dunnigan and Grimley on the elements. And no, I don't think that waiver never exists, Judge. I think that it has to be properly applied. And it couldn't be in this case, because under the Clark case, under Jenkins, we have at best an individual silence by not objecting. The individuals in both Jenkins and Clark didn't voice any objection to PSR determinations. In Jenkins, it was criminal history. And Clark, I believe it was an enhancement. But those things weren't sufficient to carry the day. And we would have then a variance, a departure from circuit precedent if we were to find here that this individual silence, not making objections, established waiver when those cases didn't. So I accept what Your Honor has said. However, I would say that the important distinctions are in what the case law says. It's not as if the district court rattled off things and got an express waiver on this. It was rather silence. And so that's insufficient under the case. That being the case, we can look to the evidence that was, and on page 11 of the appendix, we see there are no findings. It's just an adoption of the PSR. But the PSR is itself inadequate, because at paragraphs 40 and 54, there are no references to my client's intent or the materiality of any of the alleged bases for obstruction or perjury. So it's just an inadequate record. It's as simple as that. And to the extent that the government tries to shore up the inadequacies by pointing to all of the various materials in its supplemental appendix, it's important to note that the district court didn't rely on any of those things. And had it done so, the government might be in a far better position. But it is revealing that the government now is compelled to resort to reference to all of those things that the district court never once cited. And again, page 11 of the appendix shows us that. We are in a position of procedural error here, Judge, but we have to show that the plain error factors apply because my client did not object. That's as far as we get. It's a forfeiture. It's not a waiver. But there is now an error under Grimley and Dunnigan for the lack of findings. That would satisfy both the first two elements as findings are required, in addition to the elements having to be properly applied for 3C1.1. A wrongly imposed enhancement affects a defendant's substantial rights. The Porter and case from the Third Circuit, the Love case from the Seventh Circuit says that. And then lastly, using an incorrect guidelines range does seriously impact the fairness, integrity, and public reputation of the sentencing proceeding. And we'd rely on Navarro, Duran, and Porter for that.
Mr. Hillis, how does the fact that your client, during the original hearing where they're recommending the obstruction of justice for, he admitted to the materiality of his testimony. How does that impact a plain error analysis?
Well, it would do little, I think, Judge, if the admission in the prior proceeding was inadequate, to say that his admission by a pro se defendant, of course, Judge, so he doesn't know very much. He's a lightly educated individual. To use those statements and to say that those are adequate to provide the missing proof, I don't think can possibly be accomplished. We'd still need findings by the district court. There aren't any. We'd need necessary proof from the government. We're missing that as well. So it would be insufficient, even under plain error, to say that that person's statements could do anything to affect the plain error analysis, especially a pro se defendant. And the, of course, problem would go more towards waiver, but that's not sufficient to establish waiver either, Judge. It only would get us to plain error. If I may address, finally, the harmless error effort by the government. The government says that it's harmless error, but I would point to Abbas, and no Judge St. Eve is familiar with that case, as she was a district court judge at that time. And there, the district court gave a very lengthy explanation and said that the same sentence would be imposed, even regardless of the guideline calculation, should there have been any error. Such an explication is sufficient then to have a harmless error contention successfully advanced by the government on the appeal. But the government is able to point to nothing in the record here where the district court said anything along those lines. So there can't be harmless error when there is not a statement in the record sufficient to find harmless error. So that would be improper as well for the government to prevail on a harmless error argument in this case, given the lack of factual basis, the lack of statement by the district court to establish the necessaries for a harmless error. With that, I have nothing further to reserve the balance.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Stewart.
Thank you, Your Honors. The problem with the appellant's argument in this case is that it points to cases that are factually distinguishable. In this case, the court made the findings that it needed to make given the status of the party's agreement on the underlying facts. What the appellant seeks this court to require is that courts make unnecessary and rote recitations of these factors where such is not required. The purpose of making these independent explicit findings on a perjury enhancement is that oftentimes what courts are facing is a situation where a defendant has testified at trial and the jury has found the defendant to have lied or has found the defendant's testimony to be insufficient. And at sentencing, the district judge is at first making that determination of falsity, materiality, and willfulness for the first time as the finder of fact at sentencing. That's the situation that was in Dunningham, in Brindley, in Webster and Buchanan. All of these cases where the district court makes these explicit findings are cases where the district court is making that finding as a matter of first impression for that judge. That's not the case here. In this case, the district judge had already made a finding of falsity with respect to these explicit statements. So when adopting the PSR statements on these findings, the district court isn't doing so for the first time.
What about materiality, Ms. Stewart? Did the district court previously make a finding about materiality? I mean, it certainly did with respect to falsity.
No, Your Honor, the district court didn't, but Mr. Burgess admitted under oath to the materiality. And I do want to correct something that Mr. Hillis said, which was that Mr. Burgess was pro se at the time that he did that. Mr. Burgess was not pro se when he admitted to the materiality of the aspects. He was represented by counsel when he took the stand during the suppression hearing.
So where does that come into the court's analysis if we're doing a plain error analysis? Is it sufficient to say, given his admission during the testimony as to materiality, that we can infer in the PSR and infer in the court's adoption of it a finding of materiality, or does it go to a different prong of the plain error analysis? Where does that fit in?
Well, it fits. It's not just the PSR, Your Honor. It's also the fact that the district court issued a ruling, and in the district court's ruling, the district court talked about how important this issue was to Mr. Burgess, and it cited to the testimony about how Mr. Burgess understood.
In which ruling, Ms. Stewart?
I'm sorry, in the ruling on the suppression motion, okay. Judge Stattmuller's and Judge Joseph's ruling on the suppression hearing, and that was the fundamental issue at the suppression hearing. And so I think there was no doubt in anybody's mind, either on the record or in the filings that were made on those decisions, and Mr. Burgess's admissions, all of that demonstrates that everyone involved, Judge Joseph, Judge Stattmuller, the sentencing judge, Mr. Burgess himself, understood that the only issue and the material issue at the suppression hearing was whether Mr. Burgess had left the house and given police officers probable cause to believe he was there. That was the only issue at that hearing. So the materiality was well understood. Separately, and to answer your question a bit further, where it comes in on the plain error prong is the substantial rights prong. So the Supreme Court recently in Greer and Gary just last year talked a lot about what it meant, what the plain error standard was on that final prong. And the question really is whether there's a reasonable probability that the court would have imposed the enhancement if it has to go back and recite the magic words. And that's what would happen here. If this case were remanded, the district court would simply just recite the magic words pointing to Mr. Burgess's admission of materiality, the district court's conclusion at the suppression hearing regarding materiality, falsity, and willfulness, and the enhancement would be imposed again. And so the defendant can't meet that prong of the third and fourth prongs of the plain error review for that reason. And so the magic words concept really is the crux of this case, is whether the district court had to do more than it did to recite some rote recitation of materiality and falsity beyond the PSR. And the answer is no. And that is because of the different circumstances and also because the defendant did not object here. So when a defendant objects, it makes sense to require the district court to do slightly more than simply adopt the PSR or do slightly more to explain falsity, materiality, and willfulness. But in this case, Mr. Burgess didn't object.
But Ms. Stewart, that might be true if the PSR specifically addressed all of the elements of the enhancement. But Mr. Hillis's argument here is that even accepting that the district court adopted the PSR and adopted all of the factual determinations in the PSR, that on the obstruction enhancement, the PSR itself was insufficient to support that enhancement because materiality wasn't supported.
But the record is clear that there could be no, the record of the entire case is clear that there could be no
other. So I guess that's the question as to how much we can look outside of what happened at sentencing when the court didn't make any other factual findings and just adopted the PSR.
Well, the record of the sentencing itself is clear also because the government talked about materiality in its sentencing memorandum, and the court did at Appendix 22 reference the government sentencing memorandum. And so it was clear that that was that memorandum and those arguments were part and parcel of the record at sentencing. And so this court doesn't have to go beyond just the record at sentencing to find that the court did make a conclusion about materiality based on that. The fact that the court didn't feel the need to address it further makes sense because the defendant didn't object. Had the defendant objected to the materiality or anything in the government sentencing memorandum about those facts, then the court would have needed to explain why it was agreeing with the enhancement. But in this case, Mr. Burgess didn't object, so it's unlike Gage. In Gage, the defendant objected that he didn't have the culpable state of mind or willfulness when he said that the note he used to commit the robbery didn't say, "I have a gun." And then despite the defendant's objection to the willfulness piece of the enhancement, the court didn't make any findings to address that argument. In this case, the government laid out the falsity, materiality, and the willfulness in its sentencing memorandum. The PSR talked about the basis for the enhancement, and the court referenced the government sentencing memorandum at hearing. And in fact, Mr. Burgess objected to certain parts of the government sentencing memorandum, so it was clear that he reviewed it and understood that that was part and parcel of the record at sentencing. And so all the parties here were operating under those facts, under those analyses. and all the parties understood that there was a finding of materiality, willfulness, and falsity. And so there was no need for the judge in this case to recite those magic words, given the differences in the circumstances presented by Gage, Dunningham, and Brindley. Another case that might be helpful that's not cited in the government's brief, and for which I apologize, is United States versus Chichula, 757 F3rd 615. In that case, the court did not recite the magic words, so to speak, but the Seventh Circuit held that the failure to do so was harmless because there wasn't an objection, because there wasn't, where the record was clear, the defendant had willfully lied about material matters, there was no need to make the recitation of magic words.
And was that on a guideline calculation?
That was on an enhancement for perjury. And so the sentence, the court recognized that the failure to make those specific separate findings could be harmless where the record allowed the appellate court to determine the sentencing judge had found that the defendant lied about a material issue. And the concept in Chichula was this concept of the differences of what the judge is doing after trial versus what the judge is doing when a defendant objects. That court recognized those distinctions, and that this court in that case recognized that the failure to just simply recite magic words where everybody understands what the basis for the findings of falsity, materiality, and willfulness are is unnecessary, and a remand would be unnecessary for that reason, because the district court would simply make that recitation and the result would be the same. So there's no plain error, and I do think that there's waiver as well. Any further questions? Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Stewart. Anything further, Mr. Hillis?
Yes, Judge. The government, of course, didn't cite the Chichula case. If it wants to file a 28J letter, I'd be happy to respond. But, of course, we're caught flat-footed when the government comes in with new cases and new arguments. And this is the other problem. It's making a new argument. The briefing on appeals focused on whether there have been necessary findings. The government's now arguing for a distinction when there's a trial versus when there is just a sentencing procedure. But the case law says make findings. It doesn't say make findings only if there's a trial or if there's not a trial. So Dunnigan says to make findings, Brimley says to make findings, the Porter case said make findings. We need to make findings. We can't sweep it aside because we assume that the district court knew and heard everything. The district court must make specific findings that we can then review on appeal. It didn't. Relying on the PSR is also inadequate because the PSR is inadequate. Look at paragraphs 40 and 54. It's not just that there's a failure to discuss materiality. There's no discussion about intent. So of the three elements, we're missing two. In the PSR, if you want to adopt it, I suppose you adopt it at your peril. A district court could make necessary findings and support the determination of obstruction or of perjury. The district court had every ability to do that. The government gave it apparently lots of ammunition because the government keeps referring to its various pleadings that it filed and sentencing memorandum. The problem is the government points to nothing in the record where the district court adopted it and said, I accept that your offerings in these pleadings are sufficient for me to make the findings that are necessary under the obstruction case law, or for 3C1.1, for that matter. So if the PSR is inadequate, then the government hasn't met its burden of proof here by pointing to its own sentencing method. Furthermore, Judge St. Eve, you are right. We are asked here to pile inference upon inference, but that's not what the case law says. The case law says to make findings. And the district court could have done so. The government could have backed up the PSR by filing something in the district court. It didn't. I thought that it was adequate, and it wasn't. And lastly, my client was pro se at the sentencing, and that's the relevant moment. So to complain that he has been previously represented and we should look to that moment in time, I'd say is wrong. We are to look at when the district court imposed the enhancement. Was he represented there? He was not. Did the judge make the necessary findings? He didn't. Did the government meet its burden? It did not. These are the relevant things to consider for this appeal. The government hasn't been able to establish that it provided the necessary information of the district court anywhere in these proceedings at the sentencing made the necessary findings. So having been unsuccessful in the waiver termination, in our view, we cannot find harmless error here. And under plain error, the district court didn't do what it had to do. So we'd ask this court to vacate. I have nothing.
Thank you, Mr. Hillis. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.